Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Well, folks, my wonderful, wonderful audience, once again, a historian, a journalist whom I deeply admire, the author of American Betrayal. It's her second visit to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, Diana West. I want to repeat what I said earlier about Diana West, which is I'm not sure I would have been prepared to face COVID-19 and the global predators and the extent to which the American government and governments around the world have been taken over by a consortium, really, of global predators, ultimately backed, believe it or not, by communist China, the CCP, from where the virus was originally released. Whether you think it's intentional or not, that is certainly where it was first released. And her analysis, so deep, so profound, so detailed, of the infiltration of our government, the influences on President Roosevelt that allowed the Russians to take over Eastern Europe, which never should have happened, that purposely divided the Berlin, and giving a chunk to the Russians, even though we could easily have prevented them from doing anything like that. We could have protected the freedom of so many people. And there are other things in Diana's book, American Betrayal. I really recommend everybody read it. You will be a better person. You'll be a more informed person about how the U.S. repatriated, it's not the proper word for it, how we sent back people to Russia who had escaped there during the war and even fought on our side against the Russians. And Roosevelt was involved with just sending those people back to death, torture, doom. And even, which was such a big insight for me, Diana, the situation of the much admired Nuremberg trials, where we put the Nazis on trial, and in the process, and I think this is from your book too, isn't it? The process whereby we ended up joining with forces at least as bad as the Nazis, who actually killed more people probably than the Nazis, to prosecute the Nazis. What an irony of giving that absolution and that status to Stalin. If we were going to do something like the Nuremberg trial, then it certainly should not have been the U.S. and Russia. It would have been U.S. against Russia and the Germans. So we have forever been selling our souls to the communists. And part of it is because of the appeal of communism to our intellectuals and also outright placement of spies. So is that a fair analysis of some of the issues in your book?
Oh, definitely. Yes. Thank you for hosting me again, Peter. It's wonderful to be with you.
Well, I've admired you from a distance for a long time. I think my favorite thing about having my own show is I get to say to Ginger, or she says to me, should we dare call Diana West? We really would like to have her on. Make friends with her. Again, there was nothing in Diana's book that particularly said, you know, this directly applies specifically to COVID-19. What applied was the entire issue of us allowing so much influence over our policies by global predators, and also, again, communism. So that's pretty specific, actually, from Diana's book. And the direct connection, folks, to China is through the World Health Organization. And that was purposely done by Gates and by Klaus Schwab and by many others, big organizations, big groups, including journals, medical journals, all working through WHO with the Chinese communists. And of course, our funding of China itself in the building of coronaviruses, SARS coronaviruses, prior to the release of SARS-CoV-2. So, by the way, the Global Predators, our book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, is at the printer. So we're moving along, folks. We waited a long time to get everything in the book. I won't even apologize for it, because those of you who bought it in advance and had to wait, you're getting a document, a book of about 650 pages at a really low price for that. And you're getting a book that now has a huge index, which is really missing from a lot of books nowadays, not from Diana's, but from a lot of books. And you're getting the best chronology available, the longest chronology, and super endorsements from a variety of people who you'll respect. So the way to get the book is go to wearethepray.com, wearethepray.com, buy the book. You'll still get an advanced copy of the manuscript, but the book, which people have been getting for months now as the manuscripts evolves, and you'll be getting a recent copy of the manuscript immediately in the U.S. And in Europe, actually. But you'll also be getting the book pretty soon. Whatever, you know, you never know glitches and stuff, but it's in the printing process now. With God's help, we'll have it out in August, and with a little less help from God, we'll get it out in early September. Something wrong with you.
Congratulations.
I thought it would be fascinating today to talk about a weapon that is used against all criticism of attacks on the United States, especially by communism, but also by global elites. And that is that, that's a conspiracy theory. Diana has run into a lot of that. In my work, I didn't particularly run into that, because the pharmaceutical industry basically wanted to shut me down entirely. They didn't even want to call me a conspiracy theorist. They wanted to ignore me, because unlike Diana's book, which is history, my books on these issues were science, and they could not argue with any of what I was saying about what the drug companies were doing. They tried to in court. They couldn't. They wouldn't even cross-examine me on my books in court. So they just zeroed me out rather than letting people know there was a conspiracy theorist out there. And but I still got the word out, obviously, around that. But it's going to be used with this book almost certainly, if the book can't be ignored. It's going to be hard to ignore it. It's the first printing is going to be 20,000, and it's going to be hard to ignore it. So many people bought it. But this idea of conspiracy theory, I want to say one thing, and then I want to hand it over to Diana about it. I recently found a journalist disclosing, and this one came through Bobby Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., with whom I'm doing legal work. Ginger and I are on his legal team, trying to stop some of these abuses in COVID-19. And it showed that the first newspaper mention of dismissing something as a conspiracy theory was from, of all places, the New York Times in 1883. During the Civil War, there was a lot of question about whether Great Britain was going to support the U.S. or the South in the war. And there was a discussion of whether, indicating that the elite, quote, that was the word, is in the New York Times, the elite of Great Britain wanted the South to win and destroy this upstart democracy, this republic that stood for freedom and that had defeated Britain and the forces of darkness throughout the world, of oppression and monarchy and totalitarianism and dictatorship. And the New York Times said that it was a conspiracy theory to think that the British elite were not on our side in the midst of this war.
That's so, very interesting. Yeah, that's a very long time ago. I didn't know that there was, the phrase had cropped up in the 19th century. That's amazing.
Yeah, I've got a photo stat of the article.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it's to you, but the trail that it gives us as I give it over to you is, hey, conspiracy theory has been almost entirely in its most massive ways used to criticize anything about other governments and political parties wanting to undermine America, whether it's looking into the extremely legitimate issues of the election and fraud in the election, conspiracy theory, or whether the enormous amount of work you did on the communist infiltration and calling it conspiracy theory. So with that, I want to sit back and folks, this individual you're looking at, Diana West, knows this stuff as no other person, the conspiracy theory stuff. Okay.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's a really important topic because the phrase itself has been weaponized against logic, thought processes, discussion, civility, truth pursuit. I mean, it's a very powerful phrase, and you wonder how could that be? But we have a very strange society, really, that could be so cowed just by two words. But it is to stop debate, to stop research, and portray the person who's looking for the truth, who's when deception is all around, as some kind of a nut. And that's basically the power of the phrase. It makes somebody a nut, it makes somebody marginal, it makes somebody somehow kooky and not to be listened to. And the potency was discovered probably as a real weapon against the American people in the 1960s after the assassination of John Kennedy. And there is actually a document that has come out in FOIA requests from the CIA where the phrase itself is discussed as a tool. I think it's 1967 this paper came out, or was written, came out much, much later. But the implication of it was that this would be something used to knock down any critic of the Warren Commission report on the Kennedy assassination as to the ridiculous notion, really, that there was one lone gunman who had no connection to anyone else on this planet, speaking of Lee Harvey Oswald. And that phrase was something that emerged as a way to stop Americans from having questions about what had happened to their president. And although it had, of course, appeared in earlier times and so on, as you mentioned, it really became a mainstay of criminals, really, or criminals, people engaged in criminal behavior in public life to stop any sort of questioning. And it has been essentially a psyop that has been used against just simple fact gathering ever since. It goes to the heart, though. The thing that's so ironic about it is that we know conspiracies exist. The bar is so low. It just is two people who get together and have an idea that they don't share with others to put something over. So if you have just a secret agreement with someone and you go and execute it, that in and of itself constitutes a conspiracy.
Legally, I think you're saying. So that's important for people to know.
Yes,
it's a big thing used against the mafia and so on.
Well, think of the mafia in terms of, if you think that everything is a conspiracy theory and not a conspiracy, you can never prosecute a mafia gang. You can never prosecute fraud, white-collar fraud. You can never go into any sort of organized crime or criminality. So we know every day that those kinds of cases are investigated and prosecuted. So we know it exists. We know, looking at history, if you go back to Julius Caesar, the assassination of Julius Caesar, or the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, we know that conspiracies were uncovered. And so it sort of functions, you know, as this strange bifurcation of the mind, that people can know something exists and then be prey to the disinformation campaign to the effect that it doesn't, and that you must shun research that might get you entangled in discovering such a conspiracy. And I would say that American Betrayal, which you very kindly reference, is really an excursion into deception on the part of not just, you know, the communists, but the U.S. government also involved in squelching investigations, minimizing the extent of discovery of how wide these conspiracies inside the government really were, and all the rest of it in an effort to do damage control. Very often it's a tool of damage control by the powers that be. So it's a ridiculous but fascinating and effective weapon that people should just say, conspiracy theory, what are you talking about? Conspiracy fact. I mean, we can uncover them every day of the week, as you have in your new book, and as we look back in our past, and we'll be seeing them in the future. Practically everything that, because our government is so untransparent, our government hides so much from us, everything they do in that sense becomes a kind of conspiracy. When you link them up with the World Health Organization, or the World Economic Forum, or the United Nations, you are looking at the global predators and how they function. They function in the dark, and they conspire against the people. So that's kind of, it's really time to junk the whole experience.
One of the things I found out is that this particular conspiracy, the global predators and COVID-19, there's a lot of documentation no one has looked at, and it's been rather shocking to us that we, by chance, shortly before we thought we were going to publish the book 2 months earlier, and we found the blueprint, the master plan of Bill Gates that was developed through his organization he set up called CEPI, which was a foundation from about 2015 that was formally announced in 2017. Where the drug companies and lots of other groups working with WHO were going to control the next epidemic, and literally discussing how to divide the money up. I mean, and this is in the book. And then we just found a few days ago, Ginger got something come across her table, which is that Klaus Schwab, who is the, you know, every, by now folks know, is the author of the concept of the Great Reset. He has on his website laid out in depth with multiple layers of computer analysis the whole organization of the new governance of the world. And that's just amazing. And we'll write a blog about that. And it's going to go into the next book, which will be much shorter and much easier to grasp about the basic plan in more detail and depth. So that's what conspiracy is such an important issue. Now, why do you think that you're the first person? I mean, Stanton came ahead of you. There's always people ahead of us in some way or another. But you're the first person to really dive deeply into this issue of the conspiracy to undermine America during World War II in favor of Russia and USSR. Not Japan. It was, you know.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't thought of it that way. Certainly, as you mentioned, people come before me. Obviously, I'm building on their work, including Stanton Evans. But I think it was just simple and very sincere curiosity. And it actually started with my work as an editorial writer and columnist after 9/11, trying to understand why it was that we couldn't have any sort of rational or adult, if you like, conversation about Islam. And this was something that I was working with every day, because the language was so important and the fights over, you know, what we called political correctness and so on were so intense. And I was struggled with this. What is wrong with us? Why can't we talk about jihad? Why can't we talk about the impact of Islam on the Western mind? You know, all of these issues that interested me, that because they, I saw them coming down on us like a freight train. And it just kind of led me to ask myself, is there a precedent in our history where we've had similar problems having a discussion without being name called? For example, in circa 2001 or two, and you mentioned Islam critically, you were called an Islamophobe. Well, I was started reading back and found, you know, I was not as educated about communist history in our country at that time. And so I was very interested to see what had happened to people questioning communist influence being called red baiters. And this was a very important parallel, and it led me to start to try to unearth how this kind of influence could enter into our political debate and really subvert it and poison it and make it impossible and allow these various kinds of conspiracies and just essentially aggressive battle plans against our country conducted in Cold War terms, you know, not with guns, but with subversion, how they could advance. And this turned out to have a very long history in our country. And so much of it had been sort of, as I was alluding to earlier, essentially damage controlled, eliminated. The people who called it out had been marginalized as red baiters or, conspiracy theorists and so on throughout history. And as I looked at their work, which certainly, you know, preceded our situation post 9/11 by decades, I saw so many parallels, and I just thought, this is where I have to do research just to understand what's going on today, which is now 20 years ago, when you think about 9/11. But it was essentially a continuum, and we are seeing it continue now in such a, I mean, they don't even bother to hide anymore, as you're finding when you look on a website of Klaus Schwab. That plan could easily have been lodged in a drawer 40 years ago, and people who got wind of it and said, hey, they're going for a one-world government, they were told they were wearing tinfoil hats, they were conspiracy theorists, and so on, and you find out in the end that the people doing that kind of damage control are the very same people or their forebears of our global predators today. So this is a long march through the institutions, and it's. I think the reason we're so ill prepared for it and losing to it is because of the success in essentially censoring and denigrating all this area of research. You know, the biggest sin in the world is to be compared to Joseph McCarthy, who was doing investigations into communists, people under the direction of the Kremlin, who were in the American government. So in other words, they were paid by the taxpayer, they were supposed to be sworn to uphold the Constitution, but they were actually under discipline of the Kremlin. He thought that was a problem. I do too. But if you get into that area and you start to bring it back up into public view so people can say, that sounds reasonable, that's when you get slammed again and you realize that this whole thing has never gone away and it is a continuum. And right now they are poised, licking their chops for their ultimate, their final solution against us, which is, again, very serious stuff. And I make that metaphor with the Nazis very deliberately. We are in dire existential trouble, and it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, it has been. And the censorship now is already more extreme than I ever imagined I would see.
Yeah.
I mean, I was censored out, zeroed out, canceled in the middle of enormous success. Actually, by then, Ginger and I were together. Toxic Psychiatry had sold hundreds of thousands of copies, and Talking Back to Prozac then was probably between hardcover and paperback was probably 800,000 copies. And we got a $100,000 advance for a book that was going to be generally looking at the drug companies and psychiatry, which is very close to the issues today because the drug companies are probably the central organizing predator in many ways. That's why the vaccines. It's about the drug companies, and they've planned that for years now. And so we got a $100,000 contract, and the editor went on vacation immediately afterward, after the conclusion of the contract. And one day after he went on vacation, we heard from the company, we're not giving you a contract on this book. And that was the beginning of the cancellations. And never got a really big contract again, and always had to fight to get a book published. I got them published again and again and again, but with huge fights, even though I had been, my last offer had been $100,000, which we took for a book. And at the same time, I was on every single news and radio TV thing you could be on. Didn't matter. Harry King Live 2020, Oprah 5 times, Larry King 6 times, all the big stuff, the morning news, the evening news, and so on and on. And that stopped at the same time. And part of it was the drug companies got the right to directly advertise drugs. The only big country in the world, New Zealand was the only other country, directly advertised to the public. And then they really could control the media. They had controlled the whole tobacco fight because they'd been advertising cigarettes on the air for decades. And so they were able to suppress the whole tobacco cancer thing, including shutting down 60 Minutes and other places. But now they could shut down everything about drugs. And that, of course, leads right into COVID-19 because the spearhead of the conspiracy of the vaccines, it's not by chance that they want to vaccinate everybody. Everybody. Klaus Schwab said years earlier, we must vaccinate everybody. It's a political process of domination, control, creating docility, as well as billions and billions of dollars for the drug companies and all their investors. Bill Gates is one of their investors, for example, but they have many investors. So it really, it's so closely all that I went through ties in directly to what's going on now. Do you want to talk about what you ran into? It's not necessary to do it, but if you would like to talk about the turning on you of particularly the group of, oh God, I think, I hope they're not all Jews, I'm Jewish, but these Jews who were such big progressives, and then they saw the light after years of abusing America as extreme communist reps.
Yeah.
They saw the light and they became conservative, but boy, they didn't want you exposing what the degree of what they had been doing and conspiring to do. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, it is. And they're not all Jews. I'll give you the rundown. Peter Horowitz.
Thank God for that.
It's Ronald Radosh. It's two academics, John Earl Haynes, who's not Jewish, Harvey Clair. And one of their ancillary figures was Conrad Black. Those probably are the big five in terms of incessantly writing pieces.
Did you mention Horowitz? I missed the first couple of people.
David Horowitz, yeah. And the thing that's, it's almost amusing in a way, in the sense that they kept writing pieces, all of them. It wasn't enough to write one slam or one really, you know, toxic waste disinformation that I had to refute everything because it was all lies. It wasn't enough to do one. It wasn't enough to do two. The five of them, and then they ended up getting a couple of helpers, we're looking at, you know, 24 pieces in various popular to academic publications. And so when you see that kind of energy and hostility, and also this is a little conspiracy, I was told by someone on an email list from one of these men that they were trying to get everybody they knew to write something nasty about the book.
They were conspiring against you.
Conspiring. And many people did. And they would even say, I haven't read it, but. My favorite part. So it was very widespread. And there was a whispering campaign and people saying mean things and this and that. But it really flummoxed people because nobody could quite figure out what was driving this. And that became quite fascinating to people to try to understand. It was a classic disinformation campaign. And so the question is, whose ox was I goring? And why would it matter now? And, you know, some people said they're still communists. I would say that they certainly have done damage control to in their own careers to minimize the hangout, you know, limited hangout of the communist subversion in our country. I did figure out one thing about David Horowitz that I thought was potentially interesting, which had to do with his his own autobiography, which is supposed to be a tell-all. And what's interesting to me is that when he goes through his upbringing in New York City, where his parents were communist, secret communist school teachers, and he goes through the whole 1950s where he's coming of age and goes to work for the Daily Worker and things like that before he goes to Columbia, he neglects to mention that his father taught at the high school, Seward Park High School in New York City, where four members of the Rosenberg Ring were students while his father was there. He never mentions this. And this is while he's doing a tell-all. So he had, he had Ethel Greenglass and Julius Rosenberg and the brother and one of the other figures and at the school where his father taught and was a secret communist who would be fired in the 1950s. And what fascinated me for a short time, because I'm not sure it's really worth pursuing, but...
Well, it's interesting because his father participated in indoctrinating the enemies of the country.
Exactly. And was his father, who was very close friends with this man named Joseph North, who at the time was editor of the Daily Worker when David Horowitz went to work as a youth editor. He was very young. He was only a teenager. But that man is somebody who comes up in the revelations of Elizabeth Bentley, among others, she was a very famous ex-communist courier who gave tremendously important information to the government when she left the communist movement. All of it valid, all of it time-tested. She pointed out that Joseph North was a talent spotter. And it made me wonder, since he was such a good friends with David Horowitz's father, who was teaching when the Rosenbergs were coming through the school, was David Horowitz's father a talent spotter? Did he indeed indoctrinate or talent spot some of the most notorious Soviet agents in history? And isn't it interesting that his son, who's made a career being an ex-communist, comparing himself to Whitaker Chambers, which is a joke, actually allowed this to never be told, never brought any of this up, while his best friend, who was also the lead attacker on American Betrayal, Ronald Radosh, became the go-to expert on the Rosenbergs. So it's kind of an interesting bookend there of damage control, perhaps, but certainly something, is that something he's hiding? I don't know, it's something he's hidden. But in terms of motivation, you know, you don't know, because some people will say they never left the Communist Party. Other people will say, well, who does it really help? It helps the CIA. So I don't know where we come down on some of this stuff, but it's some kind of...
Explain that. It helps the CIA. What does that mean?
The CIA, I have more and more come to understand through my research, was an organization that I wish had never opened doors. It really does seem to mark in 1947 when it was inaugurated on the beginning of black budgets in our country, black secret, and I mean black in the terms of undisclosed, non-transparent, then a national security state of sorts that was in the dark to the American people, doing unaccountable things. And when this happens, this is where you really see the true foundation of what we think of as a deep state, not just the bureaucracy in the government, which is in its own kind of deep state, but this off the books, run amok, absolutely unsupervised, we don't even know what they're doing, organization that, and here's the kicker, is built into the World War II organization, the OSS. It was sort of built on the bones of that wartime group that was completely penetrated by communists, fellow travelers, and Soviet agents. And this is something that is really part of our lost history. We don't realize how we were essentially, our intelligence gathering was always subverted by some within it. And this is why when years and years later, I did meet a number of former intelligence officers as a result of American Betrayal who wanted to discuss some of these things, especially the attacks on it, which is interesting. They were very interested in these attacks on the book, in addition to the book. But one of them, a very dear man who passed away a few years ago in his early 90s, he had extensive operational experience in Asia, not Vietnam, but Asia. And he said to me on several occasions, I fought more communists inside the CIA than I ever did outside. And I don't think most people ever thought that growing up through the Cold War years.
Oh, God,
I did not look at the CIA that way. But it is an organization that, yes, John Brennan became the head of it. And that's not an accident. You know, that is not an accident that John Brennan, you may know this story, he entered the CIA having told his lie detector test operator that he had voted for Gus Hall, the Communist Party leader, for president. He had, had this communist affiliation as a young man, but he was entering the CIA, and he passed his test. And that tells you something in terms of who was giving him the test, who was looking ahead, you know, the people up the ladder who are allowing this in. And that's just one of so many examples. So it's something that always split the organization. It's not to say there weren't true patriots. Obviously, there were working inside, but this was always a problem. And that is the kind of institutional stamp that would not like to see all of this communist subversion.
Exactly. That makes so much sense. And folks, all of this has been going on for decades in every institution in America. It's so important to know that. I don't know what keeps me most from not being invited ever anymore on any kind of Ivy League campus to give a talk, where when I was young and before the pharmaceutical industries really got their grip on everybody, I was invited to talk about issues with psychiatry at Harvard and, well, you know, really all over the place, Columbia, all over the place, big schools on the West Coast, and I mentioned earlier, all the big radio shows. But this is now infiltrated everywhere. And a story I don't know that I've told at all before. When Huffington Post was formed, Arianna Huffington knew me and Ginger because she would call us occasionally. She was critical of psychiatry, and we would work with her assistant, and we would talk with her sometimes. And I remember, in fact, her saying to me one day, "Peter, you don't know what your life would be like without Ginger." And I remember saying, "Yeah, I do know, Arianna." And so we were that close. And so she made me I was one of the founding bloggers on what was originally the Huffington Post blog site, and then became the newspaper, and I was still there, the online paper. And very quickly, I realized it was being run by people who were younger than my grandchildren, it seemed, very young, very, very extremely left-wing, who loved the drug companies and psychiatry. They had no concepts of social control as being bad. It all looked good to them to take drugs, use diagnoses, and all that stuff. And very quickly, after about my third or fourth very popular posts, they created a new post for themselves of the psychiatric monitor. And so the person they were going to have monitoring my blogs was the state mental hospital superintendent of New York State. You can't epitomize more the supervisor of brutality and inhumanity than back in those days, especially. It was much worse even, but still, the head of the New York State system. And then there's all the students who tell us that they learned not to even speak in contradiction to progressives in the major universities, or they get failed. And I can remember a little bit of that starting to happen at Harvard when I was there. I mean, I remember examples where I was doubting some of the cutting edge philosophy that was, whatever it was called then, that was supposed to deconstruction everything, and way back in the 50s. And I thought, there's something to matter here. The purpose is destruction. It's not creative understanding. And being, really like, boy, you better not write that on a paper. In fact, I once helped a kid write his paper, his whole paper for one of the courses, and he got an A plus and I got a C. And because he did the BS version. And by the way, I did graduate with honors, so I'm not complaining.
Well, that's good.
But despite taking my all my pre-med courses in the last 2 years, I managed to keep my head above the water and get to medical school. But it's, folks, it's so invasive. What you're hearing in Diana's vignettes is a story of everything that's led up to today. Yes. Where, you know, people like myself are, you know, we're taken down off YouTube, we're censored, we stopped being able to get books published years ago by the major publishers, even getting agents, that all this has been just this infiltration with extreme progressivism and really now understanding that it's globalism, because communism is globalism, progressivism is globalism. It's the reason they want to take down our borders, folks, is so that everybody in the world looks the same. So that, you know, if you're an American, whether you're of Black or Chinese origin or white, or European or whatever you are, you're going to be getting the same wages as if you lived in Honduras. That's what they want. They want to level everything so they can run everything, so there are no pockets of liberty and self-determination and patriotism. And this is, I think, Diana, what it's all about. You can modify it, but I think that's kind of like what it's all about. It's destroying the American experiment.
Nation. It's the nation. The nation state is the only successful bulwark against communism or yes. Globalism. It's the nation state. And, you know, in terms of the border, a line around a country, a way of consolidating a people is anathema to them. And you know, when you go back to the 2016 Trump agenda, that was the most anti-communist agenda any president, and this, I include Ronald Reagan in this, any president had ever run on. No president had ever been as deeply, innately anti-communist as Donald Trump was in 2016. And, you know, this just unleashed the monsters everywhere because it was so successful. It was this resurgence of national feeling in America that they hated, seeing it as a big obstacle, if not a harbinger of defeat for their nefarious plan.
Nationalism and freedom. Schwab has pointed that out. You just can't have nationalism and freedom in a global world.
Yeah, they hate all of that. And, you know, it's we're so post-constitutional now. It's, you know, it's a crying tragedy every day. It's, you know, there's no law. We have, you know, a fake president. You know, it's
good.
We do. It's absolutely, there was a coup, and, you know, this is where we are. The rightful president's in Mar-a-Lago, and the Chinese puppet is in Washington. It's you know, it couldn't be worse, really. Or it could be worse. I'm sure it will be worse. But it's kind of this, you know, we're in this free fall that is very, depends on people remaining as asleep as possible, as you know.
Yeah, wake up, folks. All of you listening, wake up. This show is a fabulous wake-up call for America.
It really is, because the less freedom we have, the less freedom we will ever have. It's that dire. And I think that, you know, the global predators, as you call them, are the conspiracy, as we can understand it, are after us. You know, the vaccination is after the vaccine passport. The vaccine passport is over total control, to probably, you know, heading toward digital currency and ways of controlling all of our behavior through digital means, in terms of not being able to buy things if you don't have your vaccine, or not being able to travel, etc., and being completely under their thumb. And, you know, it's so important to get away from the centralization that is the vehicle of this, the sort of mechanism of this destruction. And it's very difficult for people, I think, I put it in these stark terms, Peter, and I wonder if you would agree. Our government is at war with the American people.
Oh, God, yes.
And it's
and hard. Freedom and patriotism, the American people.
Our very selves, as I mean, it isn't even any sort of political theory that they're at war with. They are literally at war with our persons, our individual selves, our beings, our families, our children. And I think I think a lot of people are waking up, usually after the result of a tragedy, of a vaccine injury or some such like that, the death of their business, their livelihood, etc. But not enough are waking up, because it becomes a matter of civil disobedience becomes a matter of survival at a certain point. And a lot of people just have a hard time understanding the depravity of the government, the malice of the government. And that's kind of where we are in terms of the
conspiring. I have two questions I'd love you to spend a few minutes on. I mean, one of the things is digital currency, because I think most people have no idea what power that's going to give the governments over us, and also its relationship to Bitcoin and things like that, which everybody loves because they think it's going to be decentralized. But isn't it easily going to be taken over? And I just like to ask that question. But the other one that we just don't face is how they used the invasion of Congress during President Trump's speech as a weapon against freedom in America, and what a conspiracy it was, because they literally purposely had no police to stop the break-in to the House. We watched in the videos people who looked a heck of a lot more like, progressive street fighters than any conservatives I've ever seen, breaking in windows and taking their good time about it and cheering and banging and no police. We know they called for, I think you're going to know more about this than I do, though, that we know they actually withheld the police, withheld the government troops, withheld anybody who could have protected so much so that one desperate person, maybe he wasn't desperate, but one desperate person actually shot an American woman, who was inside trying to climb up and look through a window, finally, because they were cornered at the Congress. And so, I mean, that was clearly a setup, and there's talk that a lot of the people involved in it were actually plants, progressive plants. And then they use it, and 99% of Americans seem to think, Not that many, but too many Americans seem to think that this really was a conservative attack instigated by the president, when he specifically said, it's a nonviolent protest that we're going to conduct.
That the January 6th, and there are American citizens with no criminal records, in fact, many of them with records of service to this country, who are literally incarcerated in solitary confinement, and have been for months, since January, February, March, six months, 8 months, without any of the rights that prisoners have. These are people who have not been convicted of anything, but they are in what I call, and frequently talked about this, Peter, the gulag, the American gulag in Washington, D.C. It is a travesty that is so clearly a political attack on Trump supporters, on people who have who understood that there was a election steal underway and they wanted to protest it. And in terms of what happened at the Capitol that day, you mentioned the police allowing them in. We have evidence that there were literally FBI infiltrators or FBI asset infiltrators into some of these groups, but this is being squelched as best they can. We have evidence that there was absolutely, 99% of the people there were just exercising their rights of protest. Most of the people who are now incarcerated are there on essentially glorified trespassing claims. I mean, it is such a Stalinist kind of misuse of the law. It is an utter twist of the law, and it is vindictive, but it is aimed at chilling political activity in this country.
And it has worked.
And it's worked, and it couldn't be worse. People in these jails have been essentially tortured. They are not allowed to speak to their lawyers. They are not allowed the normal recourse of discovery and getting, they won't let them have footage from that, you know, there are hours and hours of footage that was taken from many different cameras. Lawyers cannot get access to this in order to try to, you know, defend their clients. It is a travesty that is such a shame. And if it were happening in a totalitarian country in 1972, we would all be decrying, you know, the Brezhnev regime and its totalitarian tactics against political dissent. It's exactly the same thing. It couldn't be worse. It's torture and it's human rights and it's everything else, and people ignore it because the press tells them to, and they think there was an insurrection. There was no insurrection. It's ridiculous. Then meanwhile,
that's really ridiculous. I mean, you see all the time they took to, you know, bang their way in, and nobody's in the windows above trying to stop them, or the windows below, or
there was very little damage done to the Capitol.
Yes, amazingly.
There was the broken windows that you see and some doors. But I mean, when you think of how many people move through the Capitol walking past priceless art,
you know, statues, and nobody's hurting anything. That was amazing.
Ornate architectural detailing and so on, it's all fine. And when you compare that to the, you know, 6 months of Black Lives Matter and Antifa rioting that led to excess of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of damage, murders, deaths, arson, etc., those people are not paying any price. And indeed, I saw recently, or somewhat recently, there was a move to seal the records of many of these cases by a prosecutor in D.C. of the Black Lives Matter rioting, which also attacked the White House and tried to burn St. John's Church, or did burn it. Yeah. I mean, that kind of thing is okay according to law, the law, or supposed law. And these protesters, these trespassers, who, again, what were they there for? They were there to try to protest a dirty deed that was going down, which was an election steal that was going on before our eyes on January 6th. So it's heartbreaking, and it's a desecration of everything the Justice Department is supposed to stand for, but does not. And that really shows the depths to which it has been seized by this kind of dictatorial political force. So that is very bad. And as to your question on the digital slavery.
Yeah, let me interrupt there, because I want to take you to something more important than the digital. The digital coin, folks, is just simply, if the government has digital currency, you could be shopping and they could cut you off.
Right.
They will have total control over you. If you think it's bad to be cut off from YouTube, imagine being cut off from your money. So let me go to a question I have not seen anybody approach. Who is running Biden, do you think?
Oh, well, that's a very good question, and your premise is correct. The country is not being run by anyone that's been installed in the White House. Mm-mm. Biden and Kamala Harris are not calling any shots. We don't know.
Wouldn't a key figure be Biden's wife? Wouldn't it be who? Because she's the person that goes, you know, to bed with him at night and is with him at night. She thinks of herself as a big powerhouse. She was propping him up throughout the campaign. I would think that it would have to do somewhat with his wife's people through his wife, and to know her connections might help.
Well, she's a minder. For sure, she's a minder. No, I mean, I think it's not. There are some very likely suspects, and the most obvious one is the government of Communist China. The involvement of the Biden family in the Chinese banking world and financial world is documented. Hunter Biden's exploits, Biden's president, but I won't call him president, dictator Biden's brother, and so on. The family has tight financial connections and has enjoyed great munificence from China.
And John Kerry's family worked with the Biden's family in all that Chinese corruption. And he's this big weather czar or whatever, you know, to keep us under the... By the way, all these folks are implementing COVID-19. Remember that. Right. Fauci's directly connected and loved and appreciated by the Bidens. And the connections, the use of COVID-19 fits exactly into everything we're talking about. But so you think it's right to the Chinese Communist? And that makes sense from what I'm studying.
I do think so, because I think that our adversaries invest in certain candidates along the way. And I think that people say, why would the Democrats have run Biden as his mind was disintegrating so clearly, to the American people? Everyone could see it. And why would they stick with him to put him in office? And I think my own theory, just a theory, has a lot to do with the time that they have invested in cultivating the Biden family. Very important. This is not unique. We've seen this in other political families. I will say that there was a very important Chinese official who still is important in the life of the Bidens and the life of communist China. His name is Yang. I'm trying to remember his first name, but I will say that he became prominent in American and Chinese relations through his friendship originally with George Herbert Walker Bush, who went to China mm-hmm. after he left off being CIA director. Before he ran for president, they knew he was running for president. He became quite close to this man. He got one of those horrible Bush nicknames, Tiger Yang. You remember Bandar Bush? The Saudi ambassador was Bandar Bush. This guy's Tiger Yang. And he became a very important go-between between Beijing and the first Bush administration during Tiananmen Square and other scandals, who then emerged and climbed the ladder in Chinese politics. And he has an association with the Bidens as well. When Joe Biden, I think, was Senate Foreign Relations chairman, that kind of era. These people, they stay on for such a long time that I think that sort of explains why you see certain candidates hold on and stick around, because they have this kind of support or these kinds of relationships that an adversary, like China, would not want to relinquish. And it's remember the Clintons in China as well. Remember Bill Clinton essentially turning over military secrets in exchange for campaign finance contributions going back to the 1990s. I mean, this is a long cultivation of American candidates, American presidents. So it's very corrupt, it's very ugly, yeah. But I think it does explain a lot. And that
George Bush gave a speech to Congress about the war in Iraq, in which he said we were moving toward globalism. He used the word globalism. Sure. Get used to it, he said. It's definitely going to happen. And he cited that the UN peacekeeping force would be substituting for what America was doing. This is the first Bush. I'm just looking at it on a video. What?
New World Order, remember? He said New World Order every 5 minutes.
New World Order, that's what it was. New World Order. Thank you for the correction. New World Order, that's what he was saying. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. No, these people have been working at this for a very long time. We didn't really notice a lot of it along the way. But these relationships are very important, and they're incredibly disturbing. You think, well, why aren't people writing about them? Well, it's, then you find out how much Chinese money is in the American media, and you say, oh.
Well, there you go. Diana West, I have to end what is certainly one of the most important interviews I've ever had with anyone. I think that the more people who can see this, the more people will understand that those of us who haven't really had some huge axe to grind, we're actually pretty kind and gentle people, and we have taken these deep dives into what's going on. And folks, it's just awful. It is a conspiracy to destroy what's good in America. There's just no question about it, so that these very dark forces can dominate. And you do such a beautiful job. American Betrayal, that book will never grow old. It is one of the most important books in the history of, I think, the world, certainly in the history of educating this poor soul. And if you read American Betrayal and at the same time you read our book, the Global Predators book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, you're going to have just an expansive knowledge to go along with this particular interview. And again, you can get our book at wearethepray.com. Tell people your website, and we'll end with that.
Oh, sure. Thank you so much, Peter. That's so kind. My website is dianawest.net.
Dianawest.net. God, it's so good to be getting to know you personally.
Oh, thank you. Likewise.
Okay, folks, thanks for taking this seriously. This is about as serious as we can get today in America.